My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I am a gastroenterologist and also a specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Welcome to Against the Grain. I have no conflicts of interest to report, and all podcasts are free. They can be found at samir3.podomatic.com, or if you search my first and last name into the iTunes app, you should find it as well. I have a YouTube account. I have a Twitter account. Those can also be found by searching my first and last name. I do post on Twitter prior to these interviews so that I can get questions from you guys and I can ask the guests whatever you're curious about. So please become a follower, and then you can get some of your questions in as well. This time, I'm very grateful to have two guests. The first is Andrew Kornfeld, who holds degrees in neuroscience and psychology from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and has won awards for his work in science education. He has Crohn's disease and has been able to achieve clinical drug-free remission through a protocol he developed after doing his own extensive research with a lot of trial and error. Andrew is the founder of IBD Coach, which offers consulting and educational services for IBD patients to develop their own personalized treatment protocol in coordination with their health and medical team. My other guest is Lucy Mailing, who has a PhD in nutritional sciences from the University of Illinois, where her research focused on understanding how diet and exercise affect the composition and function of the gut microbiome in states of health and disease. She was recently named an emerging leader in nutritional sciences by the American Society for Nutrition and has authored several peer-reviewed journal articles related to the gut microbiome and health. Lucy is also a staff research associate for Kresser Institute and writes about evidence-based gut and skin health on her blog at ngmedicine.com. Lucy plans to continue her training and complete her MD at the University of Illinois in 2024. We had a wide-ranging discussion about several topics in IBD, including the strengths and limitations of conventional medicines, potential to reform IBD care, health insurance, supplements, dietary therapy, mitochondrial function, Candida, Genova testing, amongst many other topics. As a disclaimer, I am not endorsing or recommending any of the supplements or protocols discussed on this podcast, as they have not been FDA approved to treat Crohn's or colitis. This is an open discussion and should not be interpreted as medical advice.
Okay, so let's get started. I just wanted to ask Andrew to begin with, if you can share with us your story, your Crohn's diagnosis, and kind of what happened, what conventional treatments did you try to begin with?
Sure. Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about my diagnosis. Right when I was about 15 and a half, I attended a wilderness program, and it was really intense. We were out in Yosemite for about 8 or 9 days. I was eating a really high-carb vegetarian diet at that time and, you know, really putting a lot of stress on my body. And, you know, long story short, it was a great experience, but when I got back, I had massive amounts of diarrhea. And, you know, being out in the wilderness and drinking, just like filtered water, maybe with some iodine, I was convinced that I had Giardia. And so I convinced my doctor, even though my Giardia test came back negative, I said, I think you should just treat me for Giardia because this has to be that. I've never had any intestinal symptoms ever. And so that happened, and I just got worse significantly. I was losing a lot of weight. I was having probably maybe 10 to 12 bowel movements a day. All the traditional things, probably cramping in my lower right quadrant. And I saw a gastroenterologist, and he was really convinced about celiac disease. This is like kind of right at the time when celiac disease was just coming out, and everyone was like really excited about it and was saying, oh, everything must be, you know, related to gluten sensitivity. And then he's like, well, you have IBS as well. I'm not really that concerned about you. And yet my blood work, my CRP was elevated. My iron levels were tanking. My weight was down. I'd lost like 30 pounds. My bone density was 2 standard deviations below. I found that out later after the diagnosis.
Okay.
But, you know, finally I developed an anal fistula because of all the diarrhea, and I actually developed an anal fissure first, which doesn't sound that bad. It's one of the most excruciating things you can ever imagine. And I couldn't even sit in class. I couldn't even sit there. And I remember one time I was just in my high school class and I just walked out of class and walked home because I was just in so much pain. It was pretty unheard of. So I was given a colonoscopy, and they did find significant amount of inflammation in my terminal ileum. They found stricturing there, and I was diagnosed with moderate to severe Crohn's.
Was it just, so ileum and then perianal, right? Was there like rectal inflammation that they saw, or just the fistulas there?
I think it's just the fistula, and there was probably some inflammation there. I've always kind of attributed the fistula to the amount of diarrhea that I was having.
Okay. So what happened after that then? So they give you the diagnosis of Crohn's, and had you heard of Crohn's before that?
I was pretty young. I was like 16 when I was diagnosed, so no, I had never heard of inflammatory bowel disease. I was given steroids. I think I was given butesonide, and I did partially respond to the butesonide. Long story short, I was eventually given azathioprine or Imuran. As time went on, I was well enough to matriculate to the University of California, Santa Cruz. I studied neuroscience and psychology there, but I was always in this like purgatory, where I just was never really where I wanted to be. I was eating a full range of foods, and I always dealt with my, symptoms, but I noticed how related my symptoms were to stress. And I noticed how related they were to diet and all the other lifestyle interventions that we kind of now know are, you know, hugely influential on inflammatory bowel disease. And so, you know, I would get research papers and like present them to my doctor and say, hey, you know, I've discovered that this thing, this supplement right here, phosphatidylcholine or glutamine or whatever, this could be helpful. And they would just kind of like wave it off and be like, that's not going to do anything for you. Let's just increase your Imuran. So I was on a pretty high dose of Imuran. I graduated. You know, this is a long story short. I did a lot of cool, interesting things in college and really explored the brain in depth. And I have a big passion for neuroscience and understanding the brain. And I think this is a huge topic for IBD. Maybe we can discuss later. But I got into a second flare really, really bad. And I had mini flares. And I had actually tried in college to come off the Imuran. And I came off it very suddenly under my own direction, and I developed this crazy immune reaction after I came off, and I just had all this mucus built up all the time right after I stopped it, and I was like just constantly hacking up all this mucus, and I had a terrible reaction, and I had like a mini flare, so I just restarted the Imuran, and the mucus and stuff went away.
Okay. So, yeah, Lisi, do you have any thoughts, so far on the story?
Yeah, I mean, I actually just met Andrew a couple weeks ago. He reached out to me because he'd learned about some of my research, and it's great to hear your full story and just how far you've come since then. I think, you know, he really hasn't finished the story because he's really a different person than I think he was then in terms of his health. So maybe you can kind of finish out where you were going there.
Yeah, so after I graduated, I got into another really bad flare. I was on the Imuran. I was on about 150 milligrams. And I saw my doctors, and basically the recommendations were to add Remicade or Humira on top of the Imuran and to also remove my terminal ileum. I actually got really close to saying yes, and then I said no.
So at the time... Were they saying that the stricture you had would not respond to medicine? And is that why they were recommending? Because if the stricture was what we call fibrostenotic or mainly fibrous tissue, and there's certain ways to determine that based on imaging and what it looks like during the scope. But if it looked like that, that may have been a reason for them to say it's not worth us playing around with medications when those are unlikely to help. And sometimes we say do surgery and then start from scratch with another medicine, or we're adding Remicade after that to give you the best shot at like preventing this from happening again. So was that the rationale back then, or?
I think it was that here are we recommend both surgery and immunosuppress and adding this extra drug, or maybe they were either going to add it on top or they were going to switch me. I don't think they gave me a definitive answer whether the stricture would respond to medication, but, I did go see another gastroenterologist, and I instead decided to try a lower-end medication like mesalamine. I actually went on rifaximin for a small amount of time. I added a bunch more supplements. I also saw my naturopathic doctor. I added a pretty interesting form of curcumin called therocurmin, which is a more bioavailable version of it. I added a lot of new supplements. I did definitely became much more careful about what I was eating. I was avoiding additives and these types of things. And, you know, and frankly, just getting on a routine and putting together the pieces. And slowly, I started to see progress. You know, I think this, again, this second flare that I was in, it was stress-induced. And a big part of that stress was I was in the process of applying to medical school myself. And just to make a long story short and just to tell you how I got where I am now, I did actually attend some medical school in California. And I ultimately decided that in order to achieve what I wanted in my career, which was essentially to change healthcare and to really create a better system, that becoming a physician and seeing patients was not going to be the most efficient way for me to do that. So I left medical school, and I was still on the mesalamine, and I dove into IBD upon the urging of some of my friends. And I figured out that really one of the best ways that I could do this was by starting with really what I consider a neglected piece to this puzzle, which is the human being at the center of all of this and the patient at the center. You know, my hypothesis is, what happens if you empower the patient at the middle and you give them superpowers? Because really no one knows what, you know, you the best besides you in some ways. And, you know, that is true to a certain extent. You should always be under medical supervision. You should always listen to your doctor.
I had a couple comments or questions about kind of the management. This was probably years ago, right? This wasn't recently, but just as a kind of an editorial to the management that was done. And this is more on the conventional side, like how we treat IBD, but in the setting of having, like, you know, generally Crohn's in general, but also with like fistulas and stricturing, using mesalamine, generally speaking, is wrong in that context. It wouldn't expect to do anything. You know, mesalamine medications like Lialda, Asacol, they're pills, but they're really topical medicines that mainly work on the mucosa. And we know with Crohn's, it's like a disease that involves all layers of the bowel. It's a transmural or all layers of the bowel inflammation. And that's why you get these complications like narrowings or strictures or fistulas. And so a medicine that only works on the most superficial layer of the colon is not going to be expected to change the overall natural course of Crohn's for some people where it progresses to these complications. So from that perspective, I can understand the overall rationale, because you were trying other things, right? You were doing things with your diet, supplements, and in that context, I'm sure you were thinking, oh, I'd rather use something that has a more benign side effect profile than going on, you know, a biologic or like Remicade in addition to azathioprine, instead going the other route. Was that kind of the thought process?
I did feel like a little upset when they did recommend the combination to me, given the higher prevalence of that very aggressive lymphoma that we see in the combination of a biologic and azathioprine, especially in young men, and that I wasn't really told of that. So that was a little upsetting to me, and I think that might have been like one reason why I just sort of rejected it.
That, you know, that's good to hear, because it's true, like these biologics, these immunosuppressive medications have side effects, and the lymphoma you're referencing is a hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma, which, yes, it's more prevalent in young males. But still, as far as how many cases they've been, there's been a total of roughly about 30. Don't quote me on that. Maybe 30 or 40 total. But if you get it, it's like uniformly fatal. So that's the thing. And it has been associated with mainly the azathioprine, but you're right, with the combination, that risk is a little bit higher. But when physicians talk to patients about side effects of medications, it's, you know, my approach is I tell them every side effect. That's what I do. But not everybody does that, because there are certain ones that are so rare that it almost will color the water as far as making people not take it when the benefit may greatly outweigh this potential risk. But I understand, like, especially with that risk, I definitely tell everybody about that, especially if you're a young male. I try to avoid using that medication in young males. And it may be the case that back then there weren't as many options as there are now, but generally we do tend to avoid azathioprine in young males. But sometimes we focus on just the side effect profiles that are common, but that may not be necessarily the right decision to do that, because these rare things do happen, and again, they are rare, and also things that we don't even mention happen. I've seen many cases of people getting side effects that are not even listed anywhere and seem to be correlated with the medication, but you know, it's difficult to say definitively. So yeah, it is a scary thing to go on these medications, no question, because you're not sure what may or may not happen. But I just like to emphasize, for the vast majority of people, they tend to tolerate these medications fine without any problems.
I guess to me, like, it doesn't fully make sense to just give a medication without addressing the context of someone's situation. If you're just going to give 6-MP, which, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that goes into the bone marrow, decreases the synthesis of DNA, and it decreases the creation of white blood cells. If you're just decreasing the amount of white blood cells, that I could see why that could help, but that doesn't seem to be addressing a lot of the underlying issues of the mechanism of IBD, mm-hmm. such as your previous podcast, mm-hmm. like that was brought up by Michael Briggs.
Yeah, that is a good point, that ultimately the right answer, the textbook answer as far as what causes these conditions is, you know, there's it says, well, we don't know. I mean, there's always the standard refrain that it's a genetic susceptibility with an environmental mm-hmm. trigger, and that's what leads to the disease. And maybe Lucy, you can chime in on, you know, like the microbiome aspect of it. But as far as the causes, I have some ideas of what are the potential inputs. I think we probably share those opinions. And I think it's different inputs for different people.
Right.
But you're right, like the medications, at least the medications we use now, tend to really target the dysregulated immune system. It's not getting at the root cause, whatever that may be, for a particular individual. But yeah, and they are associated with side effects. The only thing is, we have like very strong evidence that they do work for these conditions. That's like what we have, and that's why we recommend them, because, you know, medicine has been a long history of there being, you know, it's only a relatively recent phenomenon that the way we practice medicine is evidence-based. And maybe it's very based on clinical data, clinical trials, and not just that, but very high-quality evidence. So that's what we're bound to now, because it's just been such a history of people recommending things that, you know, may have had a placebo effect, which is not a bad thing. Placebo effects are good if they work, but that didn't work, or patients paid money for things that were, you know, the snake oil salesman, right? Like there's always this fear of that in Western medicine, of things that, you know, potentially may make sense, may work, but if you don't have the clinical data to show it actually works, that's what matters. So I think that's why we're like bound to use these medications, because we have the data, and we can go into a whole other discussion of why only those medications are being studied, because of the pharmaceutical industry's influence on research and funding. But yeah, I don't know, Lucy, do you have any?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think medications definitely, absolutely have a role. And I don't think either of us are arguing that they shouldn't, for sure. You know, I actually got interested in microbiome first because I had chronic eczema for years. And I saw dermatologists, allergists, you know, trying to figure out, you know, and was just given topical, you know, creams to take care of that. And that's how I got interested in the gut and really started to change my approach to treating my eczema. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got really interested in the gut microbiome and began to research that. And at the time when I had really bad eczema, you know, dermatologists, I felt like had failed me. And I just was going to say, I don't want any drugs. I'm just going to go completely the alternative route. And I think it took me a lot longer to get back to health because I wasn't willing to use the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. I even at one point had some raw sauerkraut and had a full body flare. It was, you know, about 80% of my body was covered in eczema. And I think about now, like, if I had just taken the logical approach to get some acute treatment, you know, get some steroids, bring the inflammation down, I could then have still taken a more balanced approach. but use those medications where they were useful, you know.
Sure.
And so I feel like I've definitely come back to a place where I'm trying to, you know, understand. And I'm off all medications now. I have no eczema anymore, thanks to a lot of integrative treatments.
Mm-hmm.
But I've definitely, in my mind and in my work with clients consulting, including a number of IBD patients, I definitely see the benefit of them getting that medication support, even if they're bringing in these other diet and lifestyle modifications to support their care.
Right. Yeah, and we got into that with the previous podcast about, you know, the role of medications, at least with the Briggs protocol. He talks a lot about it in the acute phase and then potentially not using them later. I think most gastroenterologists would be nervous about that. But Andrew, keep going with your story.
I'll just respond briefly to the medications, then
sure.
I'll keep going with
yeah.
the story. But I think the issue that I see is that medications are used as crutches, not tools. And the question is how do we use medications as catalysts for the body's natural tendency to heal? How do we lower the activation energy of the inflammation enough for the barrier to be repaired? You know, and things like this, and for someone's psychological state to get under control because their IBD is stressing them out so much.
Right.
And so I think just it would be beautiful if we had a more like nuanced and more sort of like contextual way that medications were prescribed alongside a lifestyle protocol and in coordination with it.
Sure. One comment on that, and I get what you're saying. And I'm just going to give you a perspective from like the clinician and why it is the way it is.
Please.
And this is not a politically correct answer, but I'm just really giving you the truth. To start out with, the data does show that staying on these medications long-term is better as far as outcomes, less surgeries, more durable remission if you stay on it as opposed to stopping it. But that's not in the context of some of the outside-the-box things we've been talking about on the many episodes of this podcast. You know, most of that research was done in people where you just stop the drug and you're not doing anything else. You know, you're just following a regular diet, not doing anything regarding the rest of your health. But clinicians get nervous about using medicines short-term and then stopping them because, particularly with these protein-based medications, biologics like Remicade, like Entyvio, like Stelara or Humira, the risk, there is a very well-recognized phenomenon that if you start a medicine like those and then stop it, you're burning a bridge. Not all, actually most of the time you're not, but this it's still an increased risk of you potentially developing antibodies to that drug once you reintroduce it. And because we have a relatively limited armamentarium against IBD when it comes to medications, for example, like if you use Remicade to get someone with ulcerative colitis better, and then let's say you do some sort of alternative treatments or herbal treatments, changing diet, et cetera, and then the discussion comes up, can we stop the medication? So if the clinicians get nervous because if they stop it and the patient gets worse, then they're a higher risk of them not being able to restart the medicine, even though most people can. But there is a higher risk of that. And then you potentially could burn a bridge. And we do know it's a very well-recognized phenomenon as well that when the first drug you use in IBD is going to work the best. Mm-hmm. If you use a drug and then you fail a drug and then you go on to a subsequent one, the third and the fourth one, those have a less probability of actually working. So this is the context of it, and with that, that's why people are nervous, because these drugs overall, you know, and I have no conflicts of interest to report. I don't get any money from any pharmaceutical companies. This is just based on my clinical experience. I've seen many people do well long-term on medication, and that's kind of what we have, and we have data to support that. So that's why we get nervous about stopping medication.
If a biologic is working incredible for someone,
mm-hmm.
there's no reason to stop it. It's just why not add in the lifestyle on
Absolutely.
Top
yeah,
of
yeah.
the always, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's
mm-hmm.
that's all I mean.
Yeah.
And like I even believe, and this is probably not necessarily backed by, you know, clinical trials or
mm-hmm.
something, that like if someone is on Remicade or Humira or Entyvio or Stelara, one of these medications that have side effects, I would not be surprised if they were following a really healthy lifestyle protocol,
mm-hmm.
that the probability of side effects, including the really nasty ones, would probably be a little bit lower.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm saying. And I'm also saying, just why right off the bat, why immediately start with the biologic? Why not, like, you know, go up in progression? And I understand what you're saying about, you know, if they're stricturing, then you need to use a biologic. But
yeah. That's the whole thing about, like, the step up approach versus the, like, top down approach as far as using the strongest immunosuppressive medications up front. And kind of the way we decide that is based on, right, like, prognostic factors, what would suggest that this person with IBD may have a complicated course. And we do know that when you jump on inflammation earlier rather than later, it leads to better outcomes. So that's the rationale. We don't always start with the big guns. I mean, most cases of ulcerative colitis, unless it's, like, very severe, we do tend to start with mesalamine, at least give it a shot. And
which is a little anti-TNF too, right?
There's various mechanisms of how it may work. I think it doesn't have a direct effect, but maybe an indirect effect on TNF.
Lucy, you were telling me that mesalamine has a really potentially positive effect on the microbiome.
Yeah, so they've essentially, one of the mechanisms is because it's known to activate PPAR gamma, which actually shifts the metabolism of colonocytes to beta oxidation, metabolizing butyrate and other short chain fatty acids that are produced in the gut. And essentially when you have that shift, you get oxygen that's being utilized in the colonocytes. And there's a number of elegant papers that have shown this in the last couple years, but essentially when you are in that mode where you're getting most of your energy from butyrate metabolism and PPAR gamma is activated, you're not getting any oxygen leaking into the colon. And of course, we know the colon is supposed to be pretty much devoid of oxygen, but when you get leakage of oxygen, you can get the overgrowth of facultative anaerobes. And a lot of these are more pathogenic bacteria. A lot of gamma proteobacteria feed on that oxygen. And so there's evidence that mesalamine can actually positively modulate the gut microbiome by reducing the number of these proteobacteria that are inflammatory and increasing butyrate producers. So that's one particular, and I actually think that in the future we may honestly potentially use mesalamine for very difficult cases of gut dysbiosis, even when someone doesn't have overt IBD. So it's certainly an area that requires a lot more research before we use it for that purpose.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really intriguing area. And I actually feel like mesalamine is one of the few drugs I actually feel like has a positive impact on the gut microbiome based on the studies we have.
I feel like my experience when I was all out flaring with Crohn's, mesalamine did nothing for me. It basically just made things. And then once I started the lifestyle protocol in combination with mesalamine, it worked really well. And I've only been medication free for about 3 or 4 months, and I'm healthier than I've ever been. And mesalamine, I tapered it down and I stopped it. And I just felt like I'm being lazy with the, you know what I mean? With taking the mesalamine every day. And I don't need it.
Okay. Okay. So what came next then? What's I guess where we left off, you said you were on mesalamine and you had put some more supplements into your protocol, right? And just to review, what were those again, initially?
Oh, man, I have too many to even mention. But I think, the one, I can never pin it down to, like, one thing, but I think it was, like, a combination of phosphatidylcholine, theracurmin, which is, a type of curcumin, glutamine, which was really helpful, quercetin, glutathione, some of the other antioxidants. I think there's, like, two approaches, like, to this, and Dr. Briggs were kind of alluding to it, where it's, like, there's the kind of slow and steady approach, and there's, like, the kitchen sink approach.
Mm-hmm.
I was definitely the kitchen sink, approach of just, like, throw anything that has evidence that's potentially not harmful, that I know is not going to hurt me, just put it, throw it at it. And it seems to have worked because I feel amazing. I feel the best I've ever felt. I surf 15-foot waves. Well, maybe 12. I have more endurance than I ever have. I have solid bowel movements every single day. And that's a far cry from feeling like I was going to die. I mean, my bone density reversed. I'm even slightly above now, and I was 2 Z scores below, which is, and my doctors were like, we've never even seen anyone reverse bone density quite like that.
Wow. And I am curious about this. I don't think people often talk about this aspect of that approach of doing the supplements and vitamin supplements or herbal supplements. What things did you try that did not work? That actually, does anything come to mind that actually made you feel worse?
LDN, low dose naltrexone. I felt dysphoric on it. I mean, I just felt like a little bit sad, a little bit depressed. I didn't notice any, for me, I didn't notice any sort of helpfulness with my inflammatory bowel disease. And I think that kind of makes sense. Even if you're blocking your opioid receptors on a small level, I mean, those are probably important in some way for our mood. So that's one thing that's sticking out that I discontinued.
I just got an email yesterday from a listener who wanted me to do a whole episode on LDN.
I think you should do it. I think you should absolutely do it.
I tried to reach out to the author who published the original paper. I wasn't able to get through to her, but I'll try to do that. I have a similar perception of LDN. You know, I've read all the research, and I think it can help certain people with diarrhea, but I don't think it has a significant effect on inflammation. And I haven't really met a lot of people who say I'm just on LDN by itself and I'm fine. You know, maybe it's part of another regimen, but I don't think it's a very potent thing by itself to really make a difference. But yeah, people, you guys can reach out to me if you're somebody who had a lot of success with it. But okay, so I don't know if you have any other comments or
In terms of the kitchen sink approach, I think I consult or coach quite a few clients who have IBD, and I'm always, you know, discussing the evidence of some of these complementary therapies. You know, whatever recommendations I make, I always, you know, say, you know, run this by your gastroenterologist, make sure it's okay. But I definitely tend to go away from the kitchen sink approach in you know, suggesting how to try some of these things, because especially with people who potentially have more moderate to severe disease, they can be really reactive to different supplements, and something that might work really well for Andrew doesn't necessarily work well for someone else.
Yeah.
So it's very much a trial and error process. And the thing is, if you introduce 10 things at once and you feel worse, you have no idea if all 10 of those things were bad or whether 9 of them were good, but the one that really irritated your gut was the one that...
I totally agree with that. I totally agree. But devil's advocate, like, just saying... Like, say you add 10 things, then you could start taking away things and actually figure out, like, what's working, too. So, I mean, and like, what you said, too, is those people with IBD, sometimes we don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
like, time is of the essence. I don't have time to figure out which is working.
Right.
And if maybe just, I'm just saying, it's possible if I hadn't have added all these things so quickly and I hadn't made such radical shifts, I might not have a terminal ileum anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to agree. I definitely agree with you, especially given all the additives that are in supplements too. Like maltodextrin is often found in supplements. Like it's found in Jarrow probiotics, and we know maltodextrin promotes like biofilms in people that can be really antibiotic resistant, and yeah, the immune system is hard to it's hard for the immune system to penetrate.
Yeah, it is this balance. I agree. I think my general approach to doing anything when it comes to IBD is one thing at a time. But I understand the perspective of wanting to get things under control quickly and doing a lot of things. But it is a common scenario where you'll take a bunch of stuff and then maybe feel worse, and then you don't know. Then it's a guessing game as far as what caused it, or was it everything or just one thing. So it's tough. It's tough. And also these can be pretty expensive. I've heard of people paying upwards of $500 a month, every month or two, for supplements. And then it's also a question, like, yeah, it's the kitchen sink. Are some of these things even doing anything?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, you shouldn't think of medicine in a linear way, especially with this condition. Like it's assuming it's like one of the things you're taking that's mainly helping, it's probably maybe a combination of things. But there could also be things that aren't working at all or not helping at all. So one of the the advantages of doing like a step up approach to maybe like a supplement regimen is if you start to feel better after just taking like a couple or three, then you can stop,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just like see how you're doing, and then you put the other ones on the back burner and unless you really want to go that route in case you feel worse. I guess that would be the other advantage. It's kind of more like a cost saving thing. If that is an issue, if you don't have, you know, a lot of money to pay for these, and then the supplements, we don't know what are in the supplements. Like we're not, we don't have 100% confidence. Like there are certain companies, I'm not endorsing any particular company. I'm not, I honestly don't know, the purity, but I hear people say like Jarrow is relatively, but what is that based on? I don't know if people have actually reached out to this company and seen. Do you have any sense
of
that? Yeah,
it's mostly the companies that I, you know, trust, including Jarrow, are typically doing more independent third-party testing,
mm-hmm.
and they'll publish the results of that testing. So they'll send out batches regularly to be tested by a third-party lab and publish all the, basically what was found
okay.
in the supplement. So you can be more confident that it actually contains what is said on the label and
mm-hmm.
does not contain other contaminants,
mm-hmm.
Like heavy metals, detergents, the solvents that are used to extract, that kind of thing. So typically, I mean, the supplement, the scope of supplements that are out there that you can find in any grocery store is astonishing and a little bit scary because they're not regulated, so it's really important to be choosing
mm-hmm.
supplements carefully and ideally using the ones that are willing to publish the results of third-party testing.
And are there any other brands that are relatively good brands, like reliable?
I really like Thorne Research. I have no affiliation with them. I just that's another one that's done a lot of vetting. Jarrow Formulas. Those are probably the two I use most for like curcumin, other herbal or vitamin supplements. And then there's a few that are producing really high quality probiotics, which would be like Visbiome. Jarrow also produces some good probiotics.
Yeah, but they put maltodextrin.
But they put maltodextrin in some of them.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, it's definitely a place that requires some careful navigation to be sure that you're getting what you think you're getting.
I like all those brands too. Pure Encapsulations and
mm-hmm.
Integrative Therapeutics.
Yep.
Those are pretty much the only brands that I
okay.
that I engage with. I do think about that every time I take them. You know, it's like it really sucks that they're not FDA regulated. That they're
mm-hmm.
not, like,
yeah.
I think they should all be tested, just like cannabis is being tested.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Everything should be tested, and it's a shame it's not.
One thing I would suggest, and again, I'm not endorsing anything particular, but if somebody makes a decision to try some of these supplements, is to at least get your liver enzymes monitored at some
mm-hmm.
point, maybe, you know, a few weeks after starting something, because we just don't know. I mean, that's the main concern with like herbal medications, is, you know, their liver issues, acute liver injury related to it. So I would encourage that at the very least, as far as monitoring the safety, just for your, because not everybody develops liver injury.
Mm-hmm.
It can be an idiosyncratic reaction, just something that's particular to you. So, and a lot of these aren't studied. And also like combinations of things. Now we're doing combinations of products that have maybe never been combined before.
Yeah.
And especially
right.
if you're experimenting on yourself. So I would just, I'm a very big proponent of lab monitoring and making sure these things are safe.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, that reminds me of something that I just like really wanted to bring up. In the IBD world, there's so many different research papers and so many different people's opinions of this one thing works, this thing works, this thing works, this thing works. But we don't have a system in any way set up for people to figure out what combination of things work or which combination of things are potentially really, really harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the answer to that question, like, of how you figure out what is the pattern of interventions that are going to work for a given individual. You know, how are all of these things interacting? In my program, one way that we solve this is we have something called the Remission Master Plan. And basically, my clients, they go through their own medical records and they look at their entire case history of what's happened. They pick out the important tests that they've had. they list all the supplements they're taking, including all the inactive ingredients, including the brand. They make a plan for when they're in a flare, and then they then present it to their medical and health team. And it gets everyone sort of on the same page, where the different health team members are able to communicate with one another. And, you know, honestly, I'm not a physician, but I could, if I was a physician, and rather than looking through 700 pages of medical records, if I was just able to see something that was summed up pretty quick about what someone's on and what they're doing, that would be exciting for me and helpful for me.
Yeah. And that is a very typical scenario in clinic, as we get stacks and stacks and stacks of records, and it's kind of like a time waste as far as flipping through that. Most of that's just like nonsense information. It'd be better just to talk to the patient that time, but it's tough. These are very complex conditions, and especially and that's another reason why medications are so prevalent. It's just they're so easy to prescribe, you know, and they don't require much. There is a lot of monitoring and personalization that is done with medications, but to do that in addition to like other things, it's an unfortunate reality of our medical system, is that, you know, patients want, especially if you have IBD, you need a lot of time with your doctor. There's a lot of things that need to be addressed, not just the disease itself, but, you know, monitoring for other complications, health maintenance, vaccines, and like referrals. Like, for example, every IBD patient, technically, according to our guidelines, is supposed to see a dermatologist for a skin check, no matter the ethnicity or what, because just having IBD is a risk factor for getting melanoma, independent of medications. So even that, like, there's like a lot of things you have to address in a clinic visit, and so it becomes overwhelming, and it's unfortunate, but that's part of the reason why Western medicine in general is kind of like dominated by medications, is just because it's standardized and it's relatively easy to administer. Yeah.
And you don't get a lot of time with each patient necessarily for a typical visit.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, often what I've sometimes done is, because when a patient comes in and I see a lot of people who are coming, actually one person actually flew from Texas to see me, but they come with these stacks of records and they give you like 30 minutes to see a new patient. You can imagine 30 minutes is probably not even enough time to really go through those records. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I end up calling people like after clinic, you know, I apologize. I'm like, hey, this is what I'm able to gather so far, but I'm going to look through your stuff more carefully and give you a call later on.
It's not like you're even being compensated for that extra time.
Yeah.
You're exactly. Like a teacher, you know, at home, like helping her student, you know, something like that.
Yeah. It's a full-time thing. I mean, you get these messages and you're in the, like every time a patient has a phone call or sends a message, you're responsible for responding to those on a relatively regular basis every day or two. And yeah, so being a physician nowadays is not really something that's like an hourly thing. It's like pretty much during the week, it's like a 24 hour a day thing, because even I'm on call for my outpatients for the whole week. Like, so they can, if there's an emergency or something, like I'm responsible at night. So it's difficult, but it's especially within the context of IBD, when these patients require so much time, it's like the system just doesn't work for them. When it comes to using these integrative approaches or functional approaches, there are physicians who do that, and they do carve out more time for those kind of appointments, but it's difficult in this context. So.
Well, I think that's where Andrew's program may really come in useful in terms of empowering the patient to be able to learn about some of these things on their own, such that they can still review it with their doctor, but instead it's them presenting it as, you know, to their doctor, do you think this would be a good idea, rather than, you know, the doctor having to try and figure out all of the aspects of what's going on with the patient and maybe try and figure out what lifestyle aspects might be most important for that particular patient. So
And some doctors are thrilled and others are not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I can see it coming both ways for sure. But we need, you know, like we need to do something, you know, because Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, other chronic conditions, we know they're skyrocketing out of control right now. And, you know, frankly, a 30-minute visit with your gastroenterologist you know, and that's it, and just medications, that's, I don't think that's gonna cut it for our system. I actually was listening to Chris Kresser, who's a colleague of yours, Lucy, and Chris Kresser, he's a really incredible leader in the functional medicine community. And he talked about how the average cost of diabetes is like $650,000 over the course of someone's life. That's just what type 2 diabetes costs. So actually before this, I just was curious how much Crohn's and ulcerative colitis costs. And I found a recent study from, I think, 2018 that said that it's around $23,000 a year. And the average age of diagnosis of IBD is like 30 years old, roughly. A lot of people are diagnosed younger, so you could conservatively estimate where we are now in history. We would hope that people's life expectancy is going up, that they have maybe another 50 to 55 years of life. And that number is $1.2 million over the course of someone's life. So, you know, the argument that I like want to make here. So imagine, let's look at my case, and let's just pretend that I had just been like, okay, let's add in the Humira or the Remicade. Let's go ahead and remove my terminal ileum. And then let's see all the sort of secondary problems that those things could have caused. I actually didn't even tell you. I once developed a really serious infection from azathioprine, and I had to be hospitalized for it. It presented similar to food poisoning, but it was another bacterium that I can't recall right now. So let's just pretend that I was still on Humira or Remicade, and I might be getting this number wrong, but it's in the thousands of dollars per month, maybe $7,000 or something like that. So my cost and my strain on the healthcare system is like literally astronomically more if I had gone with that approach rather than the approach that I got. So I think there is a serious financial argument here to be made to insurance companies. Insurance companies, I mean, if I'm an insurance company, I don't want to pay the maker of Humira $7,000 a month, you know what I mean, if I don't have to. So how can we create educational programs and contextual situations that are covered by insurance that you know, you can't just get someone and be like, hey, go on SCD. Like the average person, that's such a huge thing. Like even for someone like me, you can't just be like, meditate every morning for 30 minutes. Are you kidding me? Like it took me like months to be able to meditate every morning at that long earning. Like all these other approaches that we know could help IBD or, you know, take your supplements every day. I have a routine that I take my supplements. I put all these baggies out and I lay them out for a month at a time and they're all sitting in my fridge and I just grab and go and I have a very specific routine every single day. This required a lot of intention and a lot of work and you can't just like spring this on someone. So we need education and training programs for people who are diagnosed with chronic conditions. And I think that IBD is potentially one of the best places to start for this because we know that, well, I'm not going to say we know, but somehow I responded. Was it a coincidence? I don't think so. I don't think that's the most logical answer. We know people like Dr. Michael Briggs responded extraordinarily well. There's thousands of other stories online of people responding to diet and people responding to lifestyle interventions in combination with medications. And these are the people who are really motivated. And every single person in my program right now is extremely motivated. I don't let anyone in the program who's not motivated. This is just who I'm starting with because I'm really setting initial conditions for what this can become. And they're constantly posting, they're constantly looking at the scientific research. And these are people with no science background. You know, I have a degree in neuroscience. You know, Lucy has a PhD in nutritional sciences. You have your MD. These are people who studied psychology or studied something else, and yet they're using very advanced terms. They've dove in, and I think our system fundamentally underestimates the potential of someone, an average person, to learn and change their life. And so we have to figure out how we can empower people to change their life.
So tell us about your program. Some more specifics about, let's say somebody was recently diagnosed with IBD.
Sure.
And potentially was in a similar situation you were in.
So
how does it work?
So my program is meant to cut, is to make up the slack, you know what I mean, between this disconnect of they only have 30 minutes with their gastroenterologist that their insurance company is going to cover, and that's it. So I think in our current healthcare system, there is a dependency, and this is, I'm not going to use the word toxic, but it's a maladaptive dependency that people walk into their doctor's office and they don't do any research at all, and they just blindly listen to everything their doctor says, which you should, but you should always be doing your own research and you should always be learning things. And because when something comes into your body, you are the first person to know potentially if something is going wrong. So in my program, it's a 6-week course. I'm currently building it out with people in the program right now. It's an exclusive Facebook community. It looks, I don't know if you've looked at any of the Facebook groups that are there for IBD. There's thousands of people in them and they're mass chaos. It's just like people will be like, you have to try this, and people are putting each other down, and it's just like, it's not good.
Yeah.
And there's just so many people in them that it would be hard to even, you know. But you have my online course with my portal. You have the Facebook group, and we do weekly Q&A calls. And nothing that we do in my program is like medical advice, like whatsoever. When someone asks about a specific supplement recommendation and they're, you know, asking about it, I might just ask them to read the supplement label, you know, and then they'll kind of come to the conclusion themselves that, you know, this supplement contains maltodextrin or something like this. And they'll be empowered to, you know, switch to a brand that is good for them, that they've worked with their health team. The trajectory of the program is like the first week is really like an introduction. The second week is just an introduction to biology and systems thinking. I'm a big proponent of thinking of things in a complex way. Mm-hmm. And some of the fundamentals of systems thinking is we look at how things are connected to one another, and we look at the relationships, and we see that certain things are foundational to other things. And when you have something like, for example, we can use a biological example, that you have the integrity of the membrane, of the mucosal membrane, if that integrity is broken and bacteria are translocating into there, that compromises the integrity of the entire system, and an emergent quality of that system is inflammatory bowel disease. So I really get them to think about the world. I get them to see the world like a little bit differently as systems thinkers. And then we go over basic biology. We go over the biology of IBD. The third week, we cover diet and nutrition. The fourth week, we talk about supplements and cannabis. The fifth week, we talk about healthcare in general and how to assemble your like really ultimate medical team. And I always encourage people to have a diverse medical team, including like a health coach, a life coach, a gastroenterologist, a functional medicine doctor, a psychotherapist. They should have all of these things. And frankly, if insurance covered all of these things for people, I bet it could potentially cost less than $1.2 million over the course of someone's life. You know, I bet the finances like could, you know, really could, or like, you know, even if they just covered part of it. And the sixth week of the program is all about mindset and really just about how to approach this and how to build routines. And I provide tools in the program. One of those tools is the Remission Master Plan, where a lot of online coaching programs, that people have to fill out all these disconnected worksheets and they're just kind of like, what is this? And instead they work on one Google document and I encourage people to think of it like a creative project. But this creative project is your life. And you know, the impact of it could be profound. And so far people are completing it at all different rates. I have one client, she just did it in like 3 nights. It was really impressive. And, I have another tool right now, like a tracking tool that people can use to make sure to just hold them accountable every day. Like, you know, did I meditate in the morning? Did I drink water in the morning? Did I take a cold shower in the morning to potentially activate the vagal nerve? Did I take my supplements today? What food did I eat? Did I have a cheat day today? Did I take my meds today? Did I get exercise? I mean, like, how do you keep track of all this stuff? And I'll just reemphasize one more time, to just get a normal American or even anyone else in the world and just be like, to just push them into this protocol. You can't do that without the support of a community. You can't do that without the support of some sort of online program, frankly, the Q&A calls help with that. And even my model, I don't think is going far enough. Like, I think this needs to lead into a place, a physical location, where people who have been stabilized, like with IBD, like say someone is diagnosed with IBD and they're stabilized, they're given prednisone, the inflammation, like in Briggs protocol, the inflammation has gone down, and then they're able to be immersed into a healing environment. Kind of, I hate to use this comparison, but kind of like drug rehab, but it's for people with autoimmune conditions. They can connect with other people who are going through. They can learn how to cook. They can learn what ingredients to buy at the store. They can see a psychotherapist to address what type of psychological issues are going on. There's a gastroenterologist there to help manage their medications. There's a functional medicine doctor there to get them on the correct supplements. And all of a sudden, you've taken a systems-based approach to care. And my bet is that one visit to that will have a profound effect for the rest of their life. And that is going to cost less than $1.2 million.
Yeah, I mean, that would be awesome if a place like that existed. I think the hurdles that are in the way now, it's mainly related to just like a medical legal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because insurance companies, sure, they would be completely on board with this. I mean, ultimately, their bottom line is profit. You know, these are for-profit companies that want to make money, spend the least amount of money to get people health care. And if they could do an approach like this, they'd be completely on board. But I think they're bound by what are evidence-based treatments. And though, you know, your particular protocol or any other protocol for IBD may theoretically make sense, that it could work, there's a lot of things that have theory behind it that have ultimately shown to not work, including medication, mainly in the medication realm. But that is the main issue, is that we don't, you know, it would be ideal if any such protocol could be studied in a prospective fashion. But even then, it would have to be done in a high quality way with a control arm, randomized controlled way, which when you're using multiple interventions, it's almost impossible to do. So it's like the system is rigged against such an intervention from being mainstream, from being covered by insurance companies. It's just the way medicine is practiced now, it's not going to happen. So
that's what people said about electric cars. You know what I mean? Like, it does,
yeah.
You know, like we need to, we need to advocate, like, in my strong opinion, for, you know, it's going to happen slowly, you know, but there does need, in my opinion, to be a multidimensional approach, because what's going to happen, right now, 50% of Americans have a chronic condition. What happens with that number is 60%, 70%.
Right.
I think the other thing is there's hundreds of studies out there of complementary therapies that have evidence for them already and are not being adequately utilized. So, for example, there's a number of probiotics that have been shown to help induce remission in IBD or help maintain remission. And if we were to utilize those strains in combination with medications, we could potentially, improve the care for so many people. And the same is true for a number of other treatments like curcumin. There is already evidence to suggest that can be beneficial. And no one has looked at, you know, a protocol that has a whole bunch of these together.
Right.
But each, and I think what's true of both Andrew's program and my blog and the writing that I do and the education we're putting out there is that it is all looking at what is the evidence for these complementary or integrative therapies, and can we take all these little pieces that are present in the literature that have evidence for them and try them as part of a comprehensive program.
I wanted to ask a few other. Is there anything else about your program that you wanted to mention? Otherwise, I just had some.
No, other than just I'm really interested in IBD, but I want it to be a model. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think IBD, I want it to be a model for other chronic conditions too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's really what drives me every day.
And how do people find your website?
So they can go to ibd.coach, or you can add me on Facebook. You can just go to Facebook and search Andrew Kornfeld, and my Facebook profile is public, and I post a lot on, on IBD.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who have IBD.
Okay, great. And how about just to get your website as well?
Yeah,
your blog?
Mine is ngmedicine.com, Next Gen Medicine is the name of it, or you can just Google my name, Lucy Mailing, and you'll find it.
And I would encourage all of you to read Lucy's blog. It's the best blog I've ever read.
Thanks, Andrew.
So you were at Digestive Disease Week, right?
I was, yeah.
In San Diego. I was there too.
Oh, yeah?
So,
okay.
Yeah, could you give us just some, within the context of IBD, just some interesting things you learned there?
Yeah, I felt like it was the first time I've actually been to Digestive Disease Week, so it was awesome to see so much just around the gut microbiome and,
mm-hmm.
and digestive diseases, because I've been to various academic conferences, but that was kind of the first around digestive disease specifically. I think there was a lot of really interesting information for me on, I learned a lot about mitochondria and how they play a role, especially in Crohn's disease. I can't remember the particular researcher now that I listened to there, but
a lot about mitochondrial DNA being that the immune system,
mm-hmm.
like that they find a lot of mitochondrial DNA in the fecal matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also the mitochondrial defects,
mm-hmm.
are often found in Crohn's disease, especially in the Paneth cells, which are what secrete the antimicrobial peptides to keep the microbes away from the gut barrier. So that was particularly interesting to me. A number of people talking about dietary approaches for IBD as well.
So mitochondria has come up now in multiple podcasts. And it's something that I've also kind of, you know, I remember learning about it in medical school, but it never really was emphasized as far as a potential cause besides certain rare mitochondrial, like maternally inherited diseases. And, you know, I've had Jack Cruz on, and then Dr. Briggs also talked about mitochondria as well in relation to butyrate, beta oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
So in that research, are you aware of, like big picture, why is that happening? Why is there a mitochondria? Are they saying it's like a genetic issue, like the mitochondrial genome, an issue with that, or is that influenced by the environment?
No, I think, well, there may be genetic components. I haven't seen any that are specific to mitochondrial function. But there are a number of environmental factors that seem to really affect the health of the mitochondria. So, like, exposure to heavy metals can really impact the mitochondria. Different food additives and emulsifiers can affect mitochondrial function. Just a lack of butyrate. So, you know, if you're eating a diet that's devoid in fiber and heavy in processed foods, you're not going to have the butyrate that's going to essentially support the health of the cell. And if you don't have healthy cells, you're not going to have healthy mitochondria.
Okay. I think I saw a news or a post that you did about, like, the fungal, I don't even call it, if it's called microbiome. Yeah, the microbiome includes fungi.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. So
if you're specifically talking about the fungal, then it'd be called the mycobiome.
Mycobiome,
mm-hmm.
Okay. And that in the setting of IBD, I think there was some study about that, right?
Yeah, there's been a number of interesting studies on the microbiome and IBD. I think it's an area that is just kind of emerging, so I'm not sure that we know much yet in terms of how to use that clinically.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do know a number of people who have treated fungal infections and seen improvements in their IBD. So it's possible that in a subset of patients that seems to be more important.
The researcher who coined the term mycobiome he's at Case Western, I think, right now. And he has, like, his own line of probiotics that claims to be, like, the only probiotic that can break digestive plaque or biofilms, which, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they are, like, often an interaction of fungal species like Candida and bacteria coming together to form these, like, biofilms. So that's an emerging area of research with IBD.
Mm-hmm. Often that's the case. I would say in terms of probiotics, there's a lot of boom in probiotics lately and a lot of interest and a lot of issues as well. So probably, I would estimate about 80% of the products out there or possibly more, are using strains of bacteria that are not have not been clinically studied or shown safety in humans, and that's a real concern. A lot of people don't realize that there's a difference between species and strain. So, for example, Bacillus coagulans, that is just genus and species.
Yeah.
You need the strain to be able to know the action of that bacterium. So same thing with like Lactobacillus plantarum. There's a number of different strains. 299V is really beneficial for IBS and IBD, but other strains have been shown to cause inflammation and have issues in terms of, you know, increasing symptoms. So that's an area that, you know, there's a lot of excitement about probiotics, and I think there's definitely some strains that have shown clinical efficacy and can be really useful, but we need that. We need the strain information to know what action it's having, and we need to match it up with the condition that you're trying to treat, almost like a medication, like you're prescribing probiotics.
The title I use in my is Pandora's Box, probiotics, you know, just like, and like even, you know, Dr. Briggs, he was recommending the coagulants one. How do you say it again?
Bacillus coagulans.
Bacillus coagulans, it promotes fecal bacterium prosnitzi, which we know is zinc, but then which strain was he referring to? You know what I mean? Like, there's a million, you know,
probably
who GBI knows?
30, but yeah.
Who knows? But anyone who listened to that will just be like, oh, I'll just get anything that
mm-hmm.
says coagulans on it. Could be a completely different strain and do nothing
mm-hmm.
or be harmful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the whole candida thing? Because it shows up. Sometimes I've seen patients come in with these Genova testing. Are you familiar with Genova
mm-hmm.
testing? Maybe you can talk about that. And then also, Candida comes up pretty frequently, and sometimes people take certain herbs to treat that, like this one called, I think it's Pseudowinterium colorata. There's like an herb I've seen people use. I think the brand name is like Colorex, and there's other, I think some people even use Diflucan.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what is your opinion of Genova?
So I often work with my clients who are interested in doing testing. I've kind of, on my blog, I've done a whole independent analysis of the direct-to-consumer tests that are available in the realm of gut health. And Genova and a few others, I believe, are kind of behind the curve in that they're still using culture-based tests to try to assess the bacterial balance in the gut. And the problem with culture-based tests is that culture selects for only certain microbes that grow really well in that particular culture that you're
yeah.
using. So most of the microbes that are present in the human gut, actually like 96%, are not, you can't grow them in culture. So you're getting a skewed assessment of what's actually there,
mm-hmm.
and you're not getting a full picture. So that's a real issue. And I've done a lot of tests where I've literally sent the same stool sample to multiple of these places to try to, assess what they're actually measuring. I've done an analysis of the different methodologies that you're using. So some are still using culture, and I think that that's, you know, unless you're looking for, like, parasitic detection where you can still use culture microscopy, you should not be using it for assessing bacterial abundance or yeast. But there are some that are using, like, quantitative PCR or other PCR-based tests, and I think that those can be useful to determine if there's a fungal overgrowth going on. So I feel like in terms of those tests, it's a little bit more nuanced as to some I do find very useful if they're using the up-to-date technologies and you're kind of taking that with all of the other, test results as well in consult with your gastroenterologist. So you're also looking at your calprotectin level, all those other markers that you're using. In terms of candida, I have seen some people where they have massive candida overgrowth on a PCR-based test and treating it, whether they ultimately decide to treat it with herbs, which I'm a little bit more hesitant about, or Diflucan or other antifungals, does seem to provide some benefit. But that is definitely a subset of patients, and there's definitely a whole lot of people who come to me and say, I have candida, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I say, like, okay, like, I'll help you, like, get access to some of these tests, and we find that, you know, they don't have candida. They might have a parasite, or they might, you know, They might just have bacterial imbalance in the gut, which is, you know, very common in inflammatory bowel disease. So I think it's very much an individual thing. I think in some cases, candida overgrowth can be an issue, but it's usually in combination with other things going on in the gut as well.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask each of you what your perspective is, and just briefly, if you can tell me your thoughts on diet, like what would be the ideal diet? Is there a difference between someone who has Crohn's and ulcerative colitis? And what are the general principles that you think are important?
So I think diet's a double-edged sword. Some of my clients and people I've seen get so obsessed with the diet and following SCD that they just start getting paranoid about all these different foods. I think like some sort of and I did a little, I went on Facebook and I just posted in about all these different groups and I got about 50 to 60 responses and I asked people how they've modified these different diets. How have you modified IBD-AID? How have you modified AIP? How have you modified SCD? All this stuff. And almost everyone is on some variation of it. No one is like, not that many people are following it strictly exactly to the book. And that was an interesting finding.
It's fascinating.
In my first video, I'm just like, follow the Michael Pollan approach and just let's keep it simple. The Michael Pollan approach is, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. But people don't understand what it means to be real food. I think if I was flaring, for example, I would be doing some sort of variation of like AIP or IBD-AID. I don't think I would go as strict as SCD. I think that would be like a little cumbersome.
Okay.
For me. But my opinion is that, if you do, and like cheating can happen, you know what I mean? Quote unquote cheating. I like to call it strategic cheating.
Uh-huh.
Like for example, I love deep dish pizza. I mean, I just want to eat it sometimes. Like sometimes it happens. And it happened once while I was here. I ate some deep dish pizza. I would not recommend anyone eat it unless you like really know what you're doing and like you plan it out. Absolutely fine. And the reason why I think I was absolutely fine, number one, I didn't like overdo it. I did it once, and my microbiome, I don't have evidence to support this because I haven't done a microbiome test, but my theory is that my microbiome is balanced and that, just one introduction of some gluten and cheese is okay. I don't eat any gluten. I don't eat dairy. I don't eat anything that's not real food.
So no dairy at all?
No, except I do a little bit of goat or sheep, and that's okay. But if I overdo that, it's not gonna be good for me.
So, but the pizza you ate, you sometimes make an exception.
Yeah, I'd say like once every 4 months or something. But pretty rare.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about you? What do you think?
In general, I think, there's not one diet that fits all. So I definitely advocate for doing some form of an elimination diet to determine what particular food triggers you might have. So AIP is a great starting place. I've had a lot of people have benefits from doing SCD and then reintroducing from there.
What about nightshades? What do you think about nightshades?
I think some people do fine with them, and other people it's like their primary food trigger.
But the scientific evidence is like kind of like says they're okay, right? Or am I wrong on that one?
You mean for inflammatory bowel disease specifically?
Yeah, like I've been hearing some people, like especially the IBD-AID people, they're like nightshades are fine. Like don't even.
I think that's true for most people. So it definitely seems like gluten and dairy are more common triggers.
Yeah.
But I do know one or two people where like nightshades just happen to be it for them.
Wow.
So I think it's very individual in terms of food sensitivities, though there's definitely, some that are more prevalent than others. I think it's really just about experimenting with diet and seeing what works best for you. I know a few people with IBD who do really well on a well-crafted ketogenic diet. And that's the only thing that's worked for them. And I think, if you find a diet that works for you, that's great. And, definitely don't try and be the least restrictive you can so that you can diversify and have a wide variety of plant foods and, And I also recommend having animal protein in there since that's really important for healing the gut. But beyond that, I really think there's a lot of room for personalization.
One thing I would add is I was lucky enough to be having a conversation with Michael Pollan, and he said, and he was like to me, you know, you might really consider trying just a little bit of sourdough bread, like from Tartine in San Francisco, which is a really good bakery. And I was like, I don't know, like I really don't want to do it. I was fine, absolutely fine, even eating it for like a week of just really fermented sourdough bread. And we know Dr. Briggs like brought it up with the mechanism of like gliadin and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just about finding the diet that works for you. And I think one thing I'll just say towards the end here is like, you know, just because one food bothered you at one time
mm-hmm.
doesn't necessarily it's going to bother you again. Just because one supplement worked for you at one time doesn't mean it's going to work for you again. Just because something didn't work for you again doesn't mean. So I think people will be like, oh, I tried that. It didn't work. But again, a contextual factor that we don't take into account is time and aging
mm-hmm.
and all the other context and the microbiome and
mm-hmm.
everything else. So that's just another layer of incredible complexity to this condition and chronic conditions.
Yeah. And I think in terms of dietary restriction as well, if you have a lot of the other lifestyle factors in place, if you're sleeping well, if you're managing stress, if you're getting exercise, often you can find that you can tolerate, sometimes you can tolerate a wider range of foods than you might not have been able to if you didn't have those other factors in check. So it depends on where you are in your healing journey, how severe your disease is. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, but
Can you briefly talk about exercise?
Sure. Yeah. So actually most of my research the last 4 years has been on the effects of exercise and the microbiome in both healthy populations and in we've done some work in mouse models of inflammatory bowel disease. So in 2013, there was a researcher in our lab, Mark Cook, who did a really elegant study where he showed that exercise, voluntary wheel running, was protective against colitis in this mouse model. Whereas forced exercise on a treadmill was actually detrimental. So it's interesting that there's actually, you know, there might be a stress component to the exercise. But we've kind of really followed this line, and we actually showed that the two types of running, the voluntary wheel running and the forced treadmill running, actually had different effects on the gut microbiome. So in the forced treadmill running, you had an expansion of microbes we think to be more pathogenic or inflammatory. Whereas in the voluntary wheel run group, we had an increase in butyrate production and in microbial diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting. And so we were actually wondering, you know, is it the effects that exercise is having on the microbiome in the voluntary wheel running that's leading to the protection against colitis?
Uh-huh.
And so we actually did what's called a germ-free mouse experiment. So we took the microbiome from sedentary or exercised mice, and we transplanted it into germ-free mice, which are basically raised in this sterile bubble. And so they have no microbiome. So then we can transplant the microbiome into these mice and see what happens. And we found that when you transplant the exercised microbiome into these mice, and then you induce colitis, they're more protected than mice that received a sedentary microbiome. So even without exercising, just receiving a microbiome that had been exercised was sufficient to provide significant protection against the colitis insult.
So Briggs had mentioned that in his review of the research that exercise contributes to leaky gut. Is that something that you think is legitimate? Or?
Yeah, so there's definitely a whole body of evidence that suggests that strenuous, high-intensity cardio produces acute gut permeability. So the question is, does that happen with regular, more moderate exercise training? And I'd actually hypothesize, and this is based on some preliminary data we've collected in our lab in human studies, that acutely exercise training may cause a slight degree of gut permeability.
Mm-hmm.
But much like exercise can strengthen your muscles over time, I believe exercise can actually potentially cause positive adaptations in the gut barrier that could strengthen it over time, especially if it's done progressively.
Mm-hmm.
obviously you don't want to push that too hard, or you could potentially end up in a flare. So that's our working hypothesis, and we're actually my lab down at UIUC is actually we're starting a trial with patients with ulcerative colitis. We're going to be putting them through a 6-week exercise intervention that's progressive. Progressive aerobic exercise, and we're going to see how it affects the gut microbiome and the gut barrier in terms of integrity as well.
So if somebody is committed to exercising and they really don't want to, but they're forcing themselves to, is that forced or voluntary?
It's hard to say. In terms of like what we've done in human studies, so we did last in 2017, we published the first longitudinal study to look at the effects of exercise on the human gut microbiome. This was in healthy adults. They were previously sedentary, and we put them through this 6-week intervention. So they voluntarily consented to the study, but then of course we were supporting them and encouraging them during the exercise sessions, and they were committed to coming in to exercise. And we did find benefits in humans in that 6 weeks of committing to an exercise program, but then also hopefully coming and having a good attitude about it. So we're hoping that we're going to see similar changes in the folks with ulcerative colitis, because we did in the previous study in healthy adults, we saw increases in butyrate producers in particular and in fecal butyrate, which could be really beneficial if the same occurs in colitis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have any, I'm not sure if this is your subspecialty, you can let me know if it's not, but regarding the role of like circadian rhythm on microbiome, and also just like when I try to exercise, I try to do it outside with the thought that just being outside may help diversify the microbiome. Is there anything to that, or is that just wishful thinking?
I don't know that, I mean, time outside, like gardening, is definitely going to diversify your microbiome. Mm-hmm. I think the benefits of there will be benefits to exercise regardless, but if you can get outside, then you're also getting that sunlight midday. You're getting a lot of other benefits from being outside in nature. So I think that's a great way to kind of stack these components. There definitely is research, and it's not my particular area of focus, but there definitely is research to support having a proper circadian rhythm and the health of the gut microbiome. And for example, they've shown in like shift workers as the extreme of a disrupted circadian rhythm that there's definitely a dysbiosis essentially in the gut microbiome. So
okay. And then I have one more question, then we'll kind of wrap it up, because I know you guys probably have better things to do than sitting this. We're definitely not.
This has been really.
We're
exciting.
In a random conference room in the hospital that I work at. That's kind of the setting we're in right now. And we're actually using Andrew's equipment because I was very unprofessional in my microphone malfunction. So thank you for that. Otherwise,
you're so welcome.
Thank you for thinking of bringing your computer. But I think there are definitely a lot of people who are going to be interested in your approach and similar approaches that are out there. But overall, I think there are people who are frustrated with the allopathic or Western medical system when it comes to treating IBD. I understand the perspective. I know where they're coming from. But there are also other people who are interested that I feel like may have difficulty following through. Like you said, your website, the people that are enrolled right now are very hyper-motivated people, right? Who have time to dedicate to this. Now, I can give you an example. I saw, and I'm not naming any names, let's just say this is an example. Let's say this isn't a real patient. I see a patient in the hospital who's 30-something years old, has 4 kids at home, a lot of them are school-aged, doesn't have a high income, is struggling to get by, new diagnosis of Crohn's possibly a few years back, has already had one surgery on the ileum, is now strictured again. Now, these are scenarios I come up with all the time. And these, a lot of patients don't have really any disposable income. They're barely able to afford any medications that are recommended. Even with insurance coverage, they have difficulty. So for those people, where do you see them? Like, are these ideal candidates for your intervention, or is it potentially modifiable for people who just don't have the funds, the time to do this? Because it's sad that, you know, potentially these things could help. Again, we don't have the strong evidence yet. But just something as simple as changing your diet, which I totally believe in, a lot of people just, they can't do it because they don't, even changing your diet to like a whole foods plant-based diet requires more funds than eating at, mm-hmm. getting your food from the dollar store or, you know, McDonald's every day. And so for some people, it's not realistic for them to do that. And I think that is sad. But any thoughts on that, on those type of, and there are also other patients who don't want to do this kind of stuff. There are patients that actually say, hey, doc, just give me a pill. I just want to get back to my life. You know, I have a busy job. I have a huge family that I have to take care of. And I don't have time to dedicate to this. I mean, when I see patients in clinic, I actually have a handout that I made regarding kind of like all, because I can't explain all this stuff mm-hmm. in a 30-minute appointment. So I give them this handout. It's just a couple pages, just like eight or nine points of what I think will help lifestyle-wise and certain other things. And I give that to them, and I say, hey, you should read this, and next time I see you, we can talk about these in more detail.
That's great.
But, you know, I know that a lot of them don't even read it. They probably throw it away on the way out of the clinic. But so there are subsets of patients who are interested in this approach. But there is also a large subset that I'm not sure are capable. But I do think they should all be aware and make that decision. Physicians shouldn't make that decision for them. But they should all be aware of it and offered that option. If this ends up getting proven that it works. And, you know, I know certain approaches have more evidence for them than others.
I really appreciate you bringing that up because I think all of us sitting in this room, we're talking from a place of privilege.
Yeah.
And it is really important to recognize that. My program, there's costs associated with it. And it's not, you know, I wish that it was possible at this point for me to just enroll everyone, but I do try. I try really, really hard. And there are scenarios where if someone shows me they're extraordinarily motivated and they are willing, especially like if someone was willing to do a GoFundMe, one of my clients did a GoFundMe and she got in. And she raised enough money for her to have some left over to use with supplement for her supplements. And so that was really awesome. But it took a lot of courage for her to do that, to just reach out to people, and not everyone is comfortable doing it in that way. Yeah, I think we do need, systematic change in order for this to occur, really. But in the meantime, programs like mine and doctors like you and students like you, Lizzie, this is what we have right now. In terms of the people who are like, hey, I just want a pill, I'm not here to motivate any. I'm not. If you don't have like the motivation right now and you just want a pill, that's fine. This is totally your life and you're up for it. But people do things every day for their own survival, and that is involved with capitalism. They get up and they go to their job every single day. Why is that so much? You know, and we think in systems thinking about what things are foundational. My grandma always told me, if you don't have your health, you don't have anything. So we need to instill a mindset into the population that health is everything. Like, if you don't have your health, you can't take care of your four kids that you have. If you don't have your health, you cannot go to your job. If you don't have your health, you cannot do anything else. So we need to find a way to make health cool again. Like, and that's what I want. How do we make health as cool as Instagram?
Right.
You know what I mean? And as everything. And that's what I think. If we can like get something going, you know what I mean? Then it's going to have a ripple effect on people who are not necessarily motivated. But for anyone listening out there, who you've been diagnosed with Crohn's and you're absolutely struggling financially, there's a lot of things you can do that don't cost any money that potentially could help. And I would argue that going to like even like one of the cheaper supermarkets The first one I'm thinking of is Safeway, which is not the cheapest one. Grocery Outlet, for example. Grocery Outlet has a lot of great vegetables. And if you do this right and we put the information out there, people could actually eat for almost the same price as fast food, if not less. But it takes time. It takes time for you to cook at home. So it's about us instilling the realization that health is foundational, that if we're, you know, that it is the most upstream gene, you know what I mean, in this whole picture, that it doesn't matter anything else in your life, your kid, you know, unless you can be there. And that's why parents put their oxygen mask on first before they put it on their child.
Great. Great. Yeah. I think you're right about that. You know, you need your health to really do anything. But I think there's a disconnect in some people's minds where they don't realize that, especially with these conditions. They don't understand what it really means to have this. And then by the time they do, after they've had surgeries and complications, then they start to realize, yeah, this is a big deal. You know, I need to get on top of this. So, okay. Lucy, any final thoughts? Anything else we missed regarding what's important for the microbiome and IBD?
No, I think just on building on Andrew's last point, I think it's just about making the tiny changes you can make today. So even if you can't overhaul your whole diet today because it feels too overwhelming, just try and make 2 better choices today in terms of your diet, exercise, sleep, etc., than you made yesterday. And you can progress that way, and things will just kind of snowball when you start taking your health back in your own hands and really making progress with those little action steps.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks for making time for this, coming out to Chicago, although you were here, but you traveled.
Yeah, thank you so much, Samir.
Yeah, maybe we can do this again in the future.
I like that. I hope there's going to be some collaboration in the future.
Yeah. You know, I'm generally very open-minded to I've done now many podcasts now, and all of these things, you know, it depends on the context of when I'm seeing a patient. If I feel like the patient is, it's all about prognosis. Like if somebody has relatively mild disease and we have time to play around with things, then, you know, I'm okay with people trying whatever they want to try, as long as I can monitor you and intervene if things look like they're getting worse, despite whatever intervention you're going to try. But I am somebody who, if I think you have severe disease based on certain clinical factors, I do like to use medication, but I encourage you to do other things, especially diet. But I'm okay with really any other types of alternative interventions you want to try, as long as I can monitor them for safety. But I do think, specifically when it comes to diet and medication, I think it's a very potent combination. That's been my approach for most patients, and I think it gives them the best shot at long-term stability and control. And I think the diet aspect gives you a sense of control of it, over your disease, as opposed to just relying on the medication, which doesn't always work out. So,
it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks
you.
So much
thank
for having us.
Thank you for your time.
Us.
Sure.